What's a wristwatch?
And then there was, there were a bunch of Australian guys that did it, the puppetry of the penis. There was the wristwatch.
Are you rolling?
There was the hamburger.
He did the hamburger. He does the hamburger in the movie. Yeah.
What's the hamburger?
You get
all right.
You get the old
fine.
Boy.
It's good. It's fine. I really know. It's fine. It's fine. I don't want to know. That's just fucked up.
You guys work a lot with a guy who is kind of known as the pointillist of show business. Very specific. Probably the most specific filmmaker there is working right now, no?
We try to work with him, yes, as much as possible. It's funny because we were just talking about pointillism the other day.
Huh.
In terms of how... Right?
We were. And I was I was all by myself because you were somewhere else and everyone was talking about it. Everyone knew what was going on. And I was all on my own kind of going, what does that mean? And I still don't know what the word means. Get that on film.
Well,
what
it's
does
just,
it mean?
It's, here, it's wait. Very, it actually fits editing perfectly.
It does. It's a really good...
Tiny
good,
little pieces that end up making the whole, but you would never know looking closely what it was.
Oh.
Do you, like, want an example?
Like that artist that did the picture of himself that's all those the little...
That's
the
kind of
the
extreme
glasses.
Version of pointillism, but yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a modern version.
Here. It'll be something that comes up in a minute.
Here you go.
That's interesting. It's a word I hadn't heard, and then, yeah. And then it comes up twice in a week. That's exactly, yeah.
There you go. But, I mean, is cutting for David different than cutting for other people? Is it easier in a way because he's so specific, or is it harder?
You always give a double-ended answer. Like, nothing's easy with David, but it's clear. So you couldn't sit back and say that it's like a breeze because there's just so much to do and there's so much depth into everything.
Yeah, and I think every movie's sort of different. I mean, I think stylistically they're all different. I think, you know, some movies are more visual than others, and some are more dialogue-driven than others. I mean, they all have a mix of both. But, I mean, I think this movie was great because it was obviously really dialogue-heavy, and you could go super deep into nuancing the performances, you know, which is because David shoots for a very specific thing and because he shoots a lot, you can actually... achieve a really finite result. You can really make something as close to perfect, if that's the right word. It's not, but as close to perfect as it can be.
Yeah,
you know, as close to as perfectly nuanced.
So is that nuance what he's trying to achieve, and you know that, so he's creating the tools for you to do that when he shoots?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's very specific. I mean, he's not like we always talk about. You know, he's not Billy Wilder where he'll do a funny take and then he'll try a sad take and then he'll try, you know, he's really gunning towards a specific thing with the actors and he shoots really until he sees it. You know, and there's a lot of other things that happen on the way that may be happenstance that are great and they end up in the final cut. But he has a very specific thing in mind.
And also, I always like to bring up, too, that he not only, you know, gets his main, you know, two-shot or close-up perfectly, if he's going to do 15 takes or how many takes to get that right one, he's also going to do the same thing with all his coverage. So we don't get cornered with having to use a certain angle because that's got the best performance. He's going to make sure he's got a great performance in every angle he's got. So editing is always completely open with where you can make the choices of where the film needs to be.
So is there a lot of conversation about what it is he's aiming at as you go into it? Or is it self-evident in the
play? It's press play.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually remarkably self-evident, like the further along you go. We'll have a conversation that'll be about the gist of the scene or about what's happening to the character, but it's usually pretty self-evident, and it's very self-evident generally what he's driving for when he's directing. I mean, when you look at the footage, we always start reviewing the footage with the last take first, or the star take, and then we kind of look back towards the earlier takes. The idea being that star take or that final take is the best, and then you can kind of go through all the preceding takes and troll for little moments that may be better. But
and I like to, we're in the middle of assembling a movie now, so it's also fresh in my head, clearly, after 12 hours of doing it today, that he'll pretty much always do his wide take first and then slowly move in. And you'll see as he moves in, he starts refining certain things as they get closer and closer. So not only do we go backwards in terms of the performance, last take first, I like to go into those close-ups first so I know where he's hunting and what he's aiming for. And then by the time I move back out to the wide, I kind of go, I'm not going to be needing the wide in all this area, or I'm not going to be needing it here because I'm going to be in this coverage over there. So we've got all these kind of like shortcuts that allow us to sort of, you know, move efficiently in the beginning. Because when all the footage hits you on day one of a scene, you kind of go,
whoa.
Yeah.
You generally know where to start looking.
Right.
You know, it's like it doesn't shortcut it any, because you know you have to look through everything, you have to really peruse everything that's available, but at least you know where to look first.
But once you work out the mathematics of how you're going to tell that particular scene or that particular story, then it's your due diligence to go back and double check that you've got all the right pieces.
Right.
So whether they're starred takes or not, then it's digging back in and clearing everything. And one might be good for picture, another one might be good for sound, another one might be good for background. And that's when we start dissecting and moving in. And that's the nuance that was in all through this film.
Yeah.
I mean, this one was really whoever with the most patience wins. Because we just keep going.
And the idea, of course, is that you have this seamless experience that the viewer is just immersed in.
Right.
And it's, you know, it should feel effortless. I mean, that's sort of our goal with the film, is to make it really feel, frankly, simple. You know, there should be nothing that is overcomplicated about that gets in the way of you and just enjoying what's happening.
So does this film as script obsessed, seemingly more so than some of the other films, as it seems, or is that an illusion of everybody talking about Aaron all the time?
Script obsessed in terms of sticking to
that
the blueprint?
That he stuck to that blueprint and that he shot the script very specifically and worked within that framework more.
It's interesting, you know, I think David's a person that likes to iron out the script before he starts shooting. So
he worked with Aaron beforehand.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he always works up until the last minute on the script to make sure that when he walks into production, he knows exactly what the blueprint is for whatever the scene is. So whether it's Aaron or David or whoever, I mean, it's when by the time he starts shooting, it's pretty locked in.
Yeah, he's not inventing things on the day.
Yeah.
He knows, he has a plan.
So generally, not offending things on the day for all the
movies. No, he might find something from its action of taking place, but he's not. Yeah, he's got a blueprint.
You kind of figure an actor like Downey is taking him places sometimes that he's not expecting to go.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like Jared Harris may have been, you know, precisely about the script and his scenes.
I was just thinking of Downey because Downey did do some improv that I think ended up in Zodiac. But you know, he's. That's who he is. I mean, his personality's that way. He's going
to
try
12,
stuff.
12,
yeah.
The same 12 times in a row.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
I mean, he's incredibly disciplined, but he's not somebody that's going to do the same thing over
Flourishes,
and over again.
We called them at the time.
Yeah.
And they're fun. I mean, they're terrific.
So on Button, was Brad allowed to do any flourishes? Is there such a thing if you're doing that much technical work on a character at the same time you're doing a performance?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's always room for that. When he's shooting.
Yeah, I'd like to put a little montage together of all those happy accidents, because David adores them.
Yeah.
There's one in Button. I mean, they're like gigantic flukes. There's one in Button where the sailboat was coming up and Brad's just gone with the rope and it's you know, traveled 10 meters and gone and wrapped around a post. I mean, there's little moments like that in every movie that are just too good to be true.
Yeah, you can never plan.
And I love the Eduardo in this one with the bottle cap when it's like thrown at Eduardo and he does little whoop, whoop, and it perfectly slips. I mean, that wasn't all this little human touches, and when they happen, well, one popped up in the movie we're doing now with Daniel Craig, and he's like popped his bottle on the top of the fridge and carried on walking, and it's gone and started to roll, and he's just gone. Yeah. One hand catched it back up. It's like, that's in the movie.
Yeah.
We can't avoid that one.
Yeah.
So has it changed dramatically for you guys since you started? You've been with him since.
Well, the first time I worked with him on a film was the titles for Seven. And then I worked a little bit on Fight Club, which was really the first time I cut the movie proper. And then my first real credit as a editor was Panic Room.
Yeah. And you've been on since Zodiac.
Correct. I came in and helped Angus on Zodiac. That was very much Angus's film.
Okay. So is it, I mean, since those early days, since now you've done three or four films, we've both done at least that, has it changed dramatically? Is it just, do you get used to each other more? Does it?
You mean in terms of us two?
The two of you, but also working with David specifically, does it,
I think
has it become easier? Is there a shorthand that becomes clearer? Or
I think, you know, it's funny, we were doing a Q&A and somebody asked, Scott Rudin was there, mm-hmm. and somebody asked, "Is it, you know, how do you know how to make sure that, you know, you've achieved what David needs to achieve?" I think they were asking one of the sound guys, and I think Scott Rudin said, "You know, it's fairly obvious what he's looking for. You know, it may not always be easy to achieve, but it's fairly obvious, you know, what he's trying to achieve. He's very clear about communicating it." And he's always been that way. I mean, I've known him since 88, and it's like I always aspire, always dreamed of being able to work with the guy, because you could see it. I mean, when he was in his 20s, he was so clear and so defined. I think people didn't, you know, they saw him as a kid, but when he started to talk, they were like, oh, my God, we actually have to really take this guy seriously, because he knows, generally he knows more, he's more of an authority on what he's talking about than anybody else in the room.
Well, he scared the crap out of everybody initially.
Yeah, no, totally.
Because he was so specific. I remember there were stories about him that were scary.
Yeah.
But he's not a scary guy. He's a very generous person. And the game that I always play with him is to try to do as much as I can for him without needing his help.
Yeah.
And he can only go so far because you need his guidance. It's his movie.
Yeah.
And so you just try to lift. He's got so much to do. You just try to lift the burden from him.
Yeah.
I mean, really is the... I mean, it's not. I don't feel sorry for him. He's doing exactly what he wants to be doing.
Yeah,
but I mean, you just try to help as much as you can.
I mean, he's incredibly generous and he's incredibly loyal. And he, you know, he does. He's worked with a lot of the same people over and over again. And I think there is a shorthand that happens when you do that.
Well, Cronenworth was saying that he, you know, now he's back with him for more than one movie in a row.
Yeah,
and that there's definitely he feels. That he's, you know, he's speaking the language more clearly each time he shoots.
Yeah.
And how did the two of you, how did this relationship start with the two of you? Have you become a team or are you a team?
Yeah, very
I'd
much
say we're
so.
Definitely a team.
Definitely a team, okay.
Yeah.
In commercials, initially.
Yeah.
I had a commercial office in New York, and whenever I worked in Los Angeles, I would work through Angus's office. And after the first time doing it, I went, well, they're doing it better. And I tried to change my office and in the end resigned and joined Angus's. So, and then Angus...
Well, he said when we first started working together commercially, he said, look, if there's ever a movie that you need help on, let me know. And Zodiac, we got to a point where it was very useful to have somebody else come on. And David said, hey, do you know anybody that would want to come on and help out on this? And I said, yeah, Kirk would be great.
So I'm pretty glad he said that.
Intimidating to walk into that?
No, it was wonderful because David was busy filming. And, I mean, I don't have the personality that's going to get scared by a director, I don't think. But, even I mean, and David was the business, especially coming out of commercials because he was the biggest thing in commercials for so many years. But I remember cutting scenes where he was away filming and I was working on a Saturday and there was no introduction to David. There was no vetting process with David. Like Angus was the vetting process. And, I was busy working on something and then David's head was here. And it kind of went, oh, what are you doing? And they show that plate again. Like, let's have a look. And then instantly started sort of giving me information or notes about it. And off he wandered and I kept revising. And then he came back and he looked at it and went, yep, that's more it. Okay, great. And it kind of hasn't changed.
Yeah. I mean, David's films are, there's a joy in watching them because it's a joy in like this accumulation of detail, this like massive accumulation of details. Mm-hmm. And I think he works that way. I mean, he works in a very detailed way. It's down, you know, when you watch, just look at the edges of the frame. in any shot. And there are little Easter eggs, visual Easter eggs, that if you pay attention, as I mean, we see them all the time because you're watching dailies, but it's like if you watch his movies, it's like any frame is so beautifully photographed. And, you know, most movies aren't like that. Most movies aren't laden. You know, there'll be a box of borax in the corner that has, you know, if you think about it, it may have some kind of weird meaning with the scene. I mean, right. The level of detail is pretty incredible.
So are you guys still cutting spots between Fincher projects, or?
Yeah.
That's the business you're in besides doing this? Because I noticed your credits are limited aside from David movies the last while.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, are you on call, essentially? I mean, do you wait for the bat phone to ring and
it's pretty close to that. We could pursue other movies. Other movies get offered, and they're hard to take because David's busy.
Yeah.
So it's, and I think we're very fortunate to have two careers in a lot of ways so that we can do commercial projects that book you for 3 weeks or something so that you are always available.
It's kind of been a conversation this year for whatever reason during the award season, because I know Spielberg for years has been doing that where his crews basically, you know, well, some of them do commercials, some of them do other things, and then the phone rings and, you know, keep your spring available and they just go to work.
Yeah.
And there's really no question about it. They just, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the project is. It's you know it's going to be something worth doing.
But there are a few other directors this year also of teams who are kind of like that where they just kind of like pick up and go. Tony Scott's another one.
Yeah.
Chris Nolan's one.
Yeah.
There's no conversation of would you like to be. It's more like it's starting in
a project that's starting in October.
Yeah.
So when you start cutting something like Girl with the Earring, I keep on calling it Girl with a Pearl Earring, which is very bad, considering I've seen the other movie and like it. All of that, but it's a bad habit. Anyway, are you reading the book beforehand? Are you paying attention? Are you reading the script and getting into it? Or are you?
Yeah. But it's such a reactionary job. Like, I read the books. Yes, I read the script. But we don't sit down and have a meeting with David about what his motivations are and bits and pieces. You react to the dailies that turn up. And that's the information that you have.
So do you get yourself excited about this is going to be so different? This is going to be something else? It's going to be... And do you get excited when projects are coming out?
Yeah.
David's theme of the day with this one was, I'm going to push the letter R as far as I can push it. And that's exciting.
Well, there doesn't seem an idea that he has, there are subtext to his choices, and that kind of Zodiac in some ways is like the anti-Seven.
Yeah.
And that he's doing that, but he doesn't talk about it a lot. So it's kind of his career in some ways is a mystery for his fans, because people are obsessed with him, really. So it's fascinating that you guys are, you know, in there doing it. But it doesn't sound like you talk about it a lot. You just intuit it the experience.
Yeah. No, I think intuit is a really good word. I mean, working with him is very intuitive. I mean, it's editing for him is very intuitive, because a lot of it is down to, I mean, there are 1,000 choices you make every day about, you know, oh, this take, this little tiny chunk of this take feels really genuine. And it's communicating this one thing, and it's a very intuitive thing. Yeah. There isn't a lot of talking about anything else in the cutting room except for the specifics of what you're working on.
But also if you view what his day is or what he gets through and how much talking he's got to do with a studio to begin or how much talking he's got to do with an actor to prepare them, he doesn't need an editing team that's saying what are our motivations here or what should we do. We're just doers. We just do.
So does it ever change so dramatically that you're surprised from where you started?
This movie
with
got funnier and funnier and funnier.
Yeah. And I think that the challenges are always different. I mean, it's hard. Every movie's so different. I mean, that's kind of the thing that makes the job great is that, you know, it's like, what other movie would you have a rowing sequence in? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That needed to be hopefully somewhat riveting, you know, or at least exciting in some way. I mean, we'll never have that again. I don't think. They're all, again, it's such a specific thing. They're all very, very different.
So when it gets funnier, is that because he's saying make it funnier, or are you just tweaking scene by scene?
Also like enjoying the, like we know when we're putting little bits of pepper and spice like all over, and I relish in all those little details because they're so hard fought. Snuffing for truffles is what David calls it. And it really is hard fought to kind of like add all those little tiny elements. I was watching, I was trying to pick out a 5-minute section of the film to play for the Invisible Arts thing. Mm. And there was this piece that we normally use, and I was looking at other bits and pieces. And I remember as Eduardo like bursts out of the boardroom door, and he's like heading up to smash the computer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you've got the wide shot just as he's, oh, that's his POV. That's right. It's his POV, and you've got the wide shot, and he spots Jesse off in the distance. But you've also got Sean there in the wide, and it's. I remember that detail getting split in, and he's in the wide, and he's just there with his coffee going. And to me, it's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's this tiny little thing that's in a widescreen. I don't think everybody's looking at it, and we just try to sprinkle those little things everywhere.
So the distance in a shot like that, for instance, when he's in the room with a guy with other lawyers. Before he comes out, you have 10 different options at that point?
Or
he's not saying, okay, this is the way I want this shot, and he only shoots it the one way, he's shooting it all the different coverage?
Oh, yeah, there's tons of coverage. I mean, generally there's tons of coverage for whatever it is.
So even when we don't see the coverage, it was there.
Oh, yeah.
Usually with him.
Yeah. But it becomes self-evident where you should be over time. I mean, there are options, of course, like there are with everything, but... Yeah.
So what did you know, I had a scene today where I wasn't sure on the best way to, you know, it starts off in a conversation of one person standing and one person here, and it's going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And then this person walks around and moves up behind, and the camera slowly comes in here. And I got three different ways to slowly come in here. Mm-hmm. Two were on the wrong side of the line and one, and I wasn't quite sure what him mathematically, mm-hmm. and a lot of that is, there's so much, because he does so much coverage, there is a lot of math in kind of working out where to be at first. And it's, in some ways, the easy part can be to pick all the performances, mm-hmm. and then, but you've got to kind of stitch this thing together seamlessly. But I sent David an assembly and just use all three approaches and just put them all in a row,
right.
hoping that he's going to go... this one, you know, and there's a clue, and then it's sped up. If he doesn't do it, then I'll look at it again tomorrow and I'll work it out.
Ruby Sky. That's what that is.
It's funny.
Do you guys get surprised, like by Ruby Sky? Do you get surprised when you see the movie with an audience?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you guys know?
Well, the classic thing is you see it through the audience's eyes. That's the that's the surprising thing. Is you no longer are thinking about where you should be looking, and you're kind of experiencing it through their eyes, and they laugh in weird places.
That's the main one.
Or in the right places,
laughter.
You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's
the other stuff's internal.
When they laugh, that's when you're, you know, it's most obvious. Mm-hmm.
But it's your own feeling. It's, you feel sick when you're watching it. I mean, you're normally trying your hardest and paranoid to begin with, right. but it gets like it goes beyond. You get hyper sensitive, which is wonderful because you're there sort of going, I've got to fix that, I've got to improve this, that doesn't look believable, I don't believe this, and you come out with, you know, finding 50 little nicks that you want to. Our first screening of this, we had like a whole, I mean, there's another 3 weeks work constantly going through it.
At least.
And everybody was happy with it at that point in the screening. Yeah. But
there were a lot of little things. It's actually, the humor really came out after that, in that 3 weeks. Those the details that kind of, the polish that happened at the end.
And getting
the
timing exactly right is what brings a lot of the humor. Getting that tight, you know, not letting it blast past you or not letting it be so flabby that it's not funny.
Did you guys know the first scene was going to be as funny as it was? In this movie?
Mm-hmm.
And have the reaction it would have?
I think it read really, really funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, it read sort of as it plays. I think their performances brought a huge amount to it. But yeah, it seemed like it was going to be...
Is it hard to cut something like that? I mean, it seems like the cut kind of is self-evident in a weird way. But
that would have been brutal. That was all Angus from start to finish. We were doing... at the time, we were both assembling, and... if you finished a scene and the next day's dailies come in and you went, all right, I got this one, and I was busy cutting the I was cutting the scene where they come out from the back of the Caribbean night, and then the next day was the first days of that, and he was like, I got this one, and then it just went and I never touched it. Angus did it from start to finish. And
I mean that's the one that Aaron said was 99 takes or whatever, right. Which we didn't get all 99 takes. That he's probably he may have shot 99 takes, considering there were two cameras and, you know, so forth and so on. But I think we probably got 60 takes. But it, you know, each take was basically 6 or 7 minutes long. So the trick with that was really breaking it down into digestible sections, and then really assessing which of those, what takes, what bits of each take of those sections was good. I mean, it wasn't something that, that I could cut the whole 6 or 7 minutes of all in one fell swoop. I had to kind of break it into subsections, cut those, and then start putting those together in the...
Erica was a one-off, wasn't it? When he's gone, Erica, and leaned in.
Yeah, I mean, that's the A-B of that is from one take. But, you know, it was actually really rewarding because it took about 3 weeks to cut the scene, and which is a really long time. But it was just because it's setting up the tone of the movie, the pace of the movie. It's sort of like a bracing beginning for the audience because you kind of go, okay, I have to pay attention. This isn't going to be like the big action scene at the beginning. I'm going to have to really pay attention. Maybe it is the big action scene at the beginning in a different way. It was
the big verbal action scene in the movie.
Yeah, it was fun.
So was there a scene like that for you? That was your grandest challenge?
Probably the end, the whole sort of blow up that happens, and Eduardo's kind of his emotional scenes in the boardroom leading up to that, when it was, you know, I was your only friend, and all of that was just one big movement that led up to the ending, and he had to be really accurate to get him pinpoint because he gave more a lot of performances that were very emotional. And if he was pouring it out in the boardroom, then it kind of diminished pouring it out when it happened for real.
Right.
So he kind of like steeled him up a little more, and it gave more room for that sort of flair.
That was kind of the trickiest performance in the whole movie, was his was Eduardo's line to Mark where he says, "I was your only friend," because Andrew was really emoting in that scene, and it seemed like that's where his emotions should really hit a peak. But it was weird because it's, you know, it was sort of this spike in the amplitude of the whole movie that just felt weird, you know. And I think that kind of got resolved really at the very end.
Yeah.
It was kind of a. At the end of the movie?
At the end of the process. I mean, it was kind of a. It was really interesting to see that kind of change because it, you know. When somebody's crying or really emoting like that, you're kind of. You're a sucker for it as an editor. You kind of go, oh my God, we have this great performance. But yeah, it was really about restraint, I think, that that whole scene.
So why did you two want to be editors in your life? Did you decide when you were 8 years old?
Mine was really clear. Amazingly, we have in different countries, we have very similar beginnings, really, really similar. Although yours is a much more fruitful production company. Mine was in Sydney, Australia, and I was the general dog's body at first in the company. And I was basically anyone's assistant doing anything, and they had a couple of stages, grips, gaffers, directors, cameramen, everything, an editorial department as well. But there was no editors there. They'd left. And so it was just, well, at that stage, it wasn't just me. So I was doing everything, and I found on set I would just lift heavy things. That was my role, was lifting things or driving things. I was a courier or a removalist. And then I worked out how to use what we used to call the punch and crunch, the three-quarter to three-quarter. And because there were so many directors and cinematographers, I would do their showreels and I would start making montages for the cinematographers of all their work and get a piece of music and build a montage like a music video. Then the younger directors, I would do their test commercials. And so I started to do this sort of thing. And I went, I'm actually doing something creative here. I'm not lifting things.
Yeah.
And my buddy that brought me into this company was a clap loader at the time. And I looked at his sort of climb to be a cameraman and all the different levels that it went through and all the years that it took. And it was it was like the army. And then I found I was editing in a week.
Yeah.
And so I ended up leaving there and eventually and joining a editorial company and just going straight in as a junior editor.
But it wasn't a calling for you? It wasn't like, oh my God, I have to be an editor? That's
no, well, it was. In a lot of ways, because I experienced all these other elements of filmmaking at the age of 17, and 18, I think, by the time I sort of stumbled onto editing, I was like, I don't want to do any of these other ones. Right. This is what I want to do. So I think when I started doing it, I was 18. I was in the business at 17, so I've been editing since I was 18, and I've not done anything else since. So that's 21 years for me.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I went to school, I studied photography and architecture, and I actually moved to LA. I went to school in Maine, and I moved to LA because I wanted to become an architect. And I was I was always fascinated with the film business. Mm. I didn't want to spend another 3 years in school, and I ended up getting a job at Propaganda Films. And I was the vault guy, very similar situation. And they did everything there. They had production, they had post. Mm. It was kind of a great, it's obviously an amazing place to be at that time. This was the late 80s. And as the vault guy, I was doing everybody's show reels. And in order to not put a glitch in between, because you were doing tape-to-tape editing, in order to not put a big glitch in between two music videos, I had to learn how to edit. Mm. So I ended up doing the same thing. I was doing everybody's montages. If somebody had a favor they needed, I would do it. Mm-hmm. And then I started working with all the different directors there. And David actually gave me my first commercial, which was, it was three Nike spots. And the other editor is a guy that I've worked with named Jim Haygood. His brother had some kind of medical emergency. He had to leave. And David basically came to me. He went, okay, get in there and cut those spots. And I was like, okay. I just went in and really didn't know what I was doing. I mean, we cut good spots, but it was a struggle. But, you know, I kind of owe him the beginning of my career. I mean, in a way, you know, photography and architecture, it's editing in a lot of ways. I mean, I used to, when I was in school, I would do these giant 8-foot by 6-foot photo collages with like hundreds and hundreds of pictures that I'd taken. And it was basically laying out time and space in two dimensions. So I kind of, when I moved out here and I saw that, you know, you could actually do this 24 hours a day, this job, you could do this as a job, I kind of went, that's what you've been doing already. You just didn't know there was a outlet for it necessarily. So it was sort of a revelation. I always wanted to find something that I could do 24 hours a day, and it wasn't enough, and this job definitely fits the bill.
It takes your time.
Yeah.
It takes your soul.
Yeah.
And could David really be the filmmaker he is in the pre-Avid universe? I mean, obviously he was a great filmmaker for the commercials and shorter form, but it sounds like he's...
Well, I think he was. I mean, I think, you know, he started when, you know, when I was there and watching him, which was 88, his career had been going for several years already. Right. I mean, you know, and everything was cut linearly or on film. I mean, he's definitely always been an advocate of pushing the technology. I mean, he and Jim would use the montage or, you know, any kind of nonlinear system they could get their hands on. They did the Laserdisc system and the beta, you know, where you had like 100 beta decks going at the same time all in pre-roll when they could afford it, because obviously it's a better way to do it. But yeah, I mean, I think his methodologies haven't really changed.
So it sounds like with all these takes, he's taking advantage of the ability to go through this much footage and to do stuff. I mean, it seems like it'd be much harder.
I think he did that in film too, though.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it just takes time.
And a lot of patience.
Yeah. I mean,
you have to be interested.
Yeah.
You have to be very curious and very interested.
I do think, you know, in earlier days, it was harder to, certainly wasn't harder. He shoots the same in terms of always driving towards a specific thing and not giving up. I mean, obviously, the way he shoots is more sophisticated now, I think, because he's done it for so many years. But, you know, he's always shot a lot of film. And I think it's easier now to kind of manage that in post-production. It's a lot easier to manage that in post-production. But I think he's always shot a lot.
Technology has risen to meet his needs.
Yeah, exactly.
And are you guys enjoying the award season as we come near to the close of it, thank God?
I can't say that I enjoy it. I mean, I love the moment. I mean, my favorite thing in all of it is the announcements, because it's private in your own home. Yeah. And my wife and I, we get up at 5 o'clock and we make the coffee, and I have a 6-year-old daughter and she gets up too. And it's really exciting and it's fun, and it gets me closer to Australia where I'm from, because all of my family get very excited. And I like the Australian press in it, because there's not many Australians that get nominated, and right. you get sort of that automatic pride for your own country. But there's a lot of sort of editing's hard to talk about, so it gets hard doing this.
Yeah.
So if that's fair.
I mean, I think you're very grateful, but it's not something that that's not the reason you work. I mean, you right. work for the joy of what you do, and that's kind of its own reward.
So did you look it up on the web? Because I guess they don't announce editing, or do they announce
it? I know, I didn't learn my lesson from this. I'm Benjamin Button. When they announced all of them on the television, they just did the top, and then there was no craft. I was like, what?
And I started, I didn't know.
No, they started looking at he sleeps.
Well, I got an email from a friend.
They're buzzing.
Yeah, and then what always happens is Tyler, our assistant, texts me with, because he knows someone that's in the room or what have you. Yeah, so I don't even know why we get up, actually, because there is no announcement. I should just leave my phone on the bedside table.
And do you have a feeling when you're in the midst of a cut or near the end of a cut, how these movies are going to fit into David's overall history, or how people might react to?
Yes, I remember saying to Angus that this wasn't going to be an award one for us.
I actually think it's really hard, because I think it's weird, because I always feel like I've experienced, it's like I have a relationship with all the characters in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to sort of divorce yourself from that and see it for a movie. It's always weird. It's always really disconcerting when it goes out in the world and it's like...
It belongs to everyone else.
Yeah, it's like you feel a little like you've gone to school in your underwear, because it's like you're really... You do feel very exposed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're just the editors. I mean, it's like that's a fraction of what I'm sure it feels like
for... Sorkin and Finch again.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to know. I mean, And I actually like that feeling. I like the feeling of kind of, you have this intimate relationship with it. Mm-hmm. You love what you've been working on. You mm-hmm. love the characters. You love the. I mean, it's sort of like you have this love affair with the movie. And you know, if people don't take to it, it's you know,
it's a lot better if they do.
Yeah, it's a lot better. But it's like the experience of that is like, kind of where it's at for me. I mean, that's
the moment
the thing
it's released. It's over. We get under this, we were talking about it before, under this illusion that it's a private thing for us, because mm-hmm. David's cutting room is very quiet and he doesn't bring in lots and lots of people for opinion. Mm-hmm. If he's getting it, he's getting it in his own ear, and he'll choose what he's going to share with us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it isn't this sort of constant sort of whirlwind of managing people. It's us and David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you do kind of get this feeling of this solo project, and when it kind of goes out there and does that, and you first start, you know, reading Turan and all these sorts of people, you're like,
oh. Do you ever get a sense of it being...
You shouldn't read those guys.
Yeah. Do you ever get a sense of it being not that? I mean, do you ever catch a glimpse of Button on HBO and go, oh, yeah, didn't... Or are you still looking at every edit? And
enjoy it more.
When it's done, it's been sealed in its own room, in the spackles around the door. It's like, it's hard to kind of get back into that headspace where you're examining
you just,
it like
you just
that.
Enjoy it.
That must be good.
It's great. I mean, it's like, it's nice to see it on TV and you kind of go, oh, wow, I forgot all about like that thing, or, you know, it's like seeing an old friend in a way. Mm.